This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You're seeing right now, in the middle of the country in particular, tens of billions of dollars of new investment in the grid. Those investments are largely driven by the need to get more renewable energy to market.
Promoters and detractors of wind power have one point of agreement. Both see the transmission lines that carry wind energy as inefficient and very expensive to build. If wind power is going to fulfill its potential as the natural, pristine, and infinitely renewable energy source that it could be, this obstacle will have to be overcome. This week's guest on Sea Change Radio, Michael Skelly, has a solution that he thinks will move us past the transmission obstacle and into an era of efficient wind power use and transfer. His company, Cleanline Energy Partners, believes it has a better way to transport wind energy, using a new technology based on the old standard direct current electricity, high voltage direct current transmission lines. Listen now as Skelly describes how a 19th century technology may be the answer to the 21st century energy question. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Michael Skelly. He's the founder and president of Cleanline Energy in Houston, Texas. Michael, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me on the show.
We often talk about the barriers for wind, that it's intermittent, and that one of the real hurdles that this technology needs to leap over is the transmission lines and trying to deliver wind across a large region. How is Clean Energy Line Partners trying to address that problem?
So here at Clean Line Energy, what we're doing is we're putting together a series of very long distance overhead transmission lines, which will move wind energy across the country. And so our lines begin in areas where it's really, really windy, but because there's not enough transmission capacity available, you can't really build more wind farms. So we start off in the windiest parts of the country, for example, the Oklahoma Panhandle. And then we'll go hundreds of miles east to the Tennessee Valley Authority system in Memphis, where we will inject 3,500 megawatts of wind energy. If we're able to pull all this together, it will mean the construction of around $6 billion of new wind farms. Another way to think about it is in terms of energy output. These new projects would produce the energy equivalent of three Hoover dams. So putting together the infrastructure will open up the opportunity for a lot of economic development and a lot of new clean energy.
And this sounds like you're building a little bit on what T. Boone Pickens' project was, in that it sounded like he kind of shelved this very ambitious project because of the transmission line issues. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, so Boone came out with a Pickens plan in 08, and he inspired a lot of people to think about a lot of new things. And we started our company in 09 with the idea that, hey, this is a pretty good idea. Let's go take this from idea to reality. And so we started the company, raised money, brought in some investors, and now we're going through all the permitting and regulatory processes, routing processes, dealing with the public, working with the thousands of landowners that we'll need to work with in order to do the best job we possibly can in siting this line. So it's fair to say that we sort of are trying to pick up where he left off.
And walk us through the technology a little bit. How is yours different from the transmission lines of 20 years ago on wind farms?
Yeah, that's a great question, because we're using direct current transmission lines. So the lines that you see around you are alternating current. Direct current, as it happens, high voltage direct current, is the most efficient way to move a lot of energy over long distances. And so whenever you have a situation where you've got an electric energy resource very, very far away from where the people need it, you'll see high voltage DC lines getting built. And in the United States, we have lines like this that go from the Canadian hydro system down to the Northeast. There's a line between the Columbia River and the city of Los Angeles that's also a direct current line. There's a few lines from the Dakotas to Minnesota. Those were originally built to move coal power over to the Twin Cities. Today, those lines are actually being used to move wind energy from the Dakotas to Minnesota. So, but the common theme here is, if you want to move a lot of power long distance, then direct current is the most efficient way to do it. So, for example, if you use the traditional AC grid, your losses would be in the sort of 15 to 20% range, but with direct current transmission lines, your losses would be more on the order of 5%.
Well, this is kind of a two-part question here. How much more efficient are the direct current lines than alternating current lines? And then B, we've heard about direct current and alternating current for decades. Why was alternating current the line of choice for so many years?
Yeah, so, you know, not to sort of rehash the war of the currents of the turn of the late 19th century, but...
No, rehash it, because most of us don't know anything about it.
Okay, so Edison first used low voltage direct current at his first power stations in New York City. And that was very suitable for short distances, because it was low voltage and direct current. Now, the advantage of alternating current is it's much easier to step the voltage up and down. And that's why most of the lines that you see in the U.S. are alternating current, because our grid isn't really built to move power around the country. It's really built to meet state and local requirements. And when you're trying to meet state and local requirements, and the distance between a coal plant or a gas-fired power plant and a city is in the, you know, tens or low hundreds of miles, alternating current technology is exactly the ticket to use, or the technology to use. So if you're using DC lines over long distance, and again, that's the right application for high voltage DC lines, it doesn't really make sense if you're going less than 250 or 300 miles. But if you're going sort of 700 miles, which is roughly what our lines go on average, your losses are in the neighborhood of 5%. If you were to use AC lines over a similar distance, and it's, so let's say it's 345 kV lines, your losses would be in the 15 to 20% range. I mean, it's going to vary by the conductor, et cetera, but that's kind of the ballpark. The other advantage of direct current is you can move a lot more power with the same set of wires. So one DC line can move a lot more power than one AC line.
About how much more?
About three times as much. And the advantage there is that, you know, right away is one of the more scarce resources. And as we work to build out the grid to accommodate this new energy mix, it's important for a bunch of reasons that we, you know, use right away as carefully as we possibly can, because it's a, you know, landowners are understandably, you know, interested in kind of limiting the new infrastructure, and you got a lot of issues to work through on that front. So the more efficient you are in the right of way that you require, well, the better it is for everybody. Just blow.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the president of Clean Line Energy Partners, Michael Skelly. So, Michael, can you give us an overview of the competitive landscape of the transmission lines, the wind energy transmission line industry, and who are the major players and how your firm fits in that whole mix?
There are a lot of interesting things happening around the United States with respect to the build-out of our grid. I'm talking to you today from Houston, Texas. And in Texas, it's a little-known fact, but over the last few years, we've undertaken a dramatic expansion of our electric transmission grid. And today, Texas, without that expansion of the grid, we're at about 10% of our electricity coming from wind energy. And so on any given day, on average, it's 10%. Some days it's a lot lower than that. And some hours we're getting 30% of our electricity from wind power here in Texas, which is, you know, if you've been to Texas, everything in Texas is a little bit bigger than normal, including the prodigious amounts of electricity that we use. So for wind energy to deliver, you know, 30% of our requirements on any given day is a pretty interesting interesting feat and interesting accomplishment by the wind industry in the last decade or so. But what happened in Texas was about 6 or 7 years ago, we started to realize that the grid was getting maxed out, that you couldn't build wind farms in the super windy areas because the transmission lines that went out there were getting filled up. So the legislature and the Public Utility Commission and the grid operator called ERCOT all got together, came up with a plan, and under that plan, which is called the CREZ plan or the Competitive Renewable Energy Zone plan, the utilities, different utilities around Texas have built out over the last few years a dramatic expansion to the grid, around $6 billion of new investment. And what that's doing is it's opening up the possibility of the construction of a whole new series of wind projects. And so today, again, we're at about 10% of our electricity coming from wind. With these new CREZ lines, we will be around 20% of our electricity coming from wind. And on some days, we'll be in the 30, 40, almost 50% percentage wind penetration. So it's pretty exciting what's happening here in Texas. And you can tell the same story about the upper Midwest and the area of Kansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma. There's a dramatic expansion of the grid taking place there as well. And what you're going to see with that expansion of the grid is a whole bunch of new wind generation facilities. Now, the other interesting trend that maybe I should talk about is how much better wind technology has gotten in the last few years. And we've all heard about the advances in shale gas production and the improvements. And we hear a little bit about the improvements on the solar energy side, which I think are really exciting as well. But on the wind side, we're getting about 30% more energy per dollar invested in a wind farm than we did just 5 years ago. And if you talk to the manufacturers, they'll tell you that there's more good things to come. So big advancements in wind technology paired up with the transmission of the grid are creating some pretty interesting energy opportunities right here in the U.S.
And when you mention these CREZ lines, are these the direct current lines that your company makes?
No, the ERCOT grid is, so Texas, you may be surprised to learn, is actually electrically an island. But the great thing about Texas being an electrical island is that it allows for a lot more innovation because, you know, you got one political body, the Texas legislature, you got one regulator, the Public Utility Commission, you got one grid operator, ERCOT. And so these three parties can get together and figure out, you know, what we want to do with the grid. The challenge that we have elsewhere in the country is you've got multiple states, lots of different utilities, several grid operators, public utility commissions, et cetera. And getting all those folks on the same page, you know, can present its challenges.
Now let's turn to the policy, to some of the incentives for wind energy to generation projects to be built. How much do transmission lines get bundled into these policy bond measures and other ways to try to move towards a cleaner energy future?
Okay, so in the U.S., we have typically two mechanisms to get more renewable energy into the mix. And one is called the production tax credit, which is a tax credit of roughly 2 cents a kilowatt hour that wind producers get if they generate. Now, if they don't generate any electricity, they don't get any incentive. The other, let's call that a supply side incentive. So that increases the supply of renewable energy. Then on the demand side, we have something called renewable portfolio standards. So in Texas and Minnesota, and I think it's 28 other states, we have laws on the books that say on a state-by-state basis, we would like X percentage of our electricity to come from non-polluting resources. In Texas, it's actually in the low single digits. We're way, way ahead of it. Most states were way ahead of these targets because what happens with these demand side incentives is what happens is the utilities go, okay, well, we'll buy some of that. Then they realize that it fits pretty well into their existing resource mix. It's fairly low cost. It's good for their consumers, and their customers really like it. So once you get a renewable or a wind energy industry going and in a particular state, what I've seen, and I've been doing this for about 15 years, is there, another sort of dynamic takes over and all the stakeholders get moving and more projects get built.
Ready to again begin. Always walking to the wind.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the president of Clean Line Energy Partners, Michael Skelly. Clean Line Energy Partners makes high-voltage direct current transmission lines for the wind energy industry. So, Michael, we've heard a lot about green jobs and the promise of green jobs, and wind is certainly part of that equation. Can you break down the mix between how many jobs you see the wind farms creating versus the lines? It would seem like the lines are a very labor- and capital-intensive undertaking.
Yeah, so if we're building a transmission line, it's going to cost like a 700-mile HVDC transmission line. It's going to cost a couple of billion dollars to build that. The labor bill, the labor component of that is well into the hundreds of millions of dollars. So it's a lot of jobs and thousands of people working to build a line like that. The other really exciting part about what we're doing is that if you do build transmission out to these windy areas, you can be very confident that folks will come along and build wind farms to tap into those lines. And the construction of the wind farms and the operation of the wind farms will create thousands of jobs as well. And we've seen that story play out across the country, not only on the construction side, but the manufacturing side. Today, for a while there, about 10 or 15 years ago, we imported most of the equipment that we used in the wind business. But today, two-thirds of the value added in a wind turbine comes from U.S. sources. And that's because we've had a period of, relatively consistent policy for the last, there have been some bumps and grinds along the way, but for the last 7 or 8 years, we had a fairly good run of consistent federal policy to provide tax incentives to the wind industry. And that meant that a lot of manufacturing came to the U.S. because in the wind industry in particular, these are big blades, big turbines, big nacelles. So if you can manufacture them close to where they get installed, you save a lot of money on shipping.
What drives the production of these wind farms based on the lines and the farms and geography and technological limitations?
Yeah, so what really drives, it's like the real estate business, it's location, location, location. And what really drives the cost of wind energy is where you put the turbine. And if you put the turbine in a place like Western Kansas versus, say, Kentucky, you're just going to get dramatically more energy. And just in the energy, another way to think about that is in the energy content of the wind, there's probably 4 or 5 times as much energy just in the wind itself available to be tapped in Kansas versus, say, Kentucky. So it's all about location.
How much does wind cost? How does it stack up against fossil fuel energy?
Yeah, so that's kind of that's the question of the hour. And the best way to think about wind is it's really low cost fuel whose price does not change over time. So a lot of people say that, the complaint is, well, the wind doesn't blow all the time. That is absolutely true. The wind does not blow all the time. But when it does blow, that means you don't have to burn all these fossil fuels. So the value of wind to the grid is really a function of fossil fuel displacement, both for economic reasons and for environmental reasons. So wind today, with the production tax credit, you can produce wind for about 2.5 cents, which competes head-to-head with any and every single source of fossil fuels in the U.S. today.
2.5 cents per kilowatt hour, correct?
Correct.
So how does that stack up against, let's say, natural gas or coal?
Well, so natural gas is around, today's natural gas prices, it's probably around 3 cents. Today's coal prices around 2.5 cents. So wind priced at 2.5 cents is a pretty attractive option. If you compare the cost of wind without the production tax credit, and there it would be, around 4.5 to 5 cents. It's a little more expensive than the other sources. However, the huge advantage of wind is there's obviously no pollution associated with it, and the cost does not vary over time. So you can sign wind contracts today that say, hey, I'll buy your wind for 3 cents next year, and I'll pay you 3 cents 30 years from now. And you'll have plenty of people who will take that deal.
And are there any technologies in place or down the road that are helping to offset the intermittency issue?
The intermittency issue at today's grid penetration levels is not really a big issue. So as I mentioned, we regularly hit 30% wind power here in Texas, and the grid operates just fine. In Colorado, which is a state with a great wind resource and a utility that's really committed to clean energy, a utility called Xcel, they have hit 55% wind production, and the lights stay on and the grid runs just fine. How do they do that? The way they do that is there are other units on the system that can respond quickly, and that helps with the integration of wind. So the technology for wind integration is already there and it's being deployed. And there's many, many examples of successful integration of wind. Let me just give you another example. In the Midwest ISO, which is the upper Midwest, that's a grid operator up there. In the Midwest ISO's footprint, about 10 years ago, they had 1,500 megawatts of what are called spinning reserves. And those are plants that spin in case something goes wrong with the grid. They're there and ready to go. 10 years ago, they had 1,500 megawatts of spinning reserves in the Midwest ISO. Today, even though wind has more than quintupled in that same period of time, they have the same 1,500 megawatts of spinning reserves. Why is that? It's because grid operators have gotten really good at integrating wind into the rest of the energy mix, and they're able to tap into the flexibility that other power plants have. So this question of wind integration is an issue, but it's not much of an issue at today's penetration levels.
It needs to be a piece of the puzzle. You don't think wind can stand alone. If we can start figuring out ways to store that energy when the wind is not blowing.
Yeah. So if you wanted to go to a grid that was 100% wind powered, then you would definitely need some storage devices and some storage technologies. But at today's grid levels of 10, 20, 30%, you can do all of this without a lot of storage or even without any storage. And we've seen that hold true in Texas. It's happening in Colorado. It's happening in the upper Midwest. And it's certainly happening in a number of cases in Europe. So it's important that we make improvements in technology or in storage technology, particularly for mobile applications like vehicles. But it's not the fundamental thing that's holding wind energy back today.
There's been a lot of controversy surrounding the Cape Wind project and a lot of high profile, not in my backyard type hubbub, especially on the coasts. But in the middle of our country where there's just tremendous wind resources, it's an important piece of our electricity generation, isn't it?
Yeah, and what we're seeing is a dramatic expansion of the grid driven by a need for more clean energy. The interesting thing that we've seen around the country over the last 5 years or so is that when utilities and grid operators get together and folks work hard at expanding the grid, that expansion can really take place. And you're seeing right now in the middle of the country in particular, tens of billions of dollars of new investment in the grid. And those investments are largely driven by the need to get more renewable energy to market. And the exciting thing about that is, you know, we're proving the thesis that we really can build important infrastructure in this country. And those projects are going off. You know, there's certainly a lot of challenges associated with them, but the capital's there, the companies are there, the technology's there, and there's a lot happening to expand the grid. And that's a really good thing in terms of the energy mix for this country.
Michael Skelly, he's the president of Clean Line Energy Partners. People can go to cleanlineenergy.com to learn more. Michael, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me. Enjoy chatting.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Fred Wesley and the JBs, Soul Searchers, and Danger Muffin.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.